Evidence and Answers begins right now.
This is Evidence and Answers radio broadcast with our host, Pat Zukeran. Pat is an author, teacher, and international speaker in the area of Christian apologetics, the defense of the Christian faith. Thomas Aquinas is one of the greatest thinkers and theologians of church history and Western civilization. What can this medieval scholar teach us about truth, theology, faith, ethics, and the meaning of our existence? The last time we were together, Pat and his guest, Dr. Richard Howe, began part one of this fascinating discussion about how Aquinas' ideas continue to influence discussion on natural law, bioethics, and the ultimate purpose of life in today's world. If you've missed any part of this interview, log on at evidenceandanswers.org, and there you will find this discussion entitled Thomas Aquinas, the Angelic Doctor, and find hundreds more podcasts that you may download or listen online. Now let's get right into part two of this three-part discussion.
So exploring this, the sort of ins and outs of, okay, so exactly what is it about a thing when we talk about its existence? I would submit to your viewers and hearers that that is the central doctrine of Aquinas' metaphysics, is understanding his distinction, because what he'll do with it is show that if anything exists at all right now, then there must be something whose very essence is existence itself, what the theologians call supreme being, right? So God is not just a thing that has existence. We are things that have existence because we've been given existence by God and are continually sustained in existence by God. This is the way Aquinas would argue. But God is a being. It's not even right to call him a being, as if he's just another thing in the universe that happens to exist. We're saying, no, he's being itself, existence itself. Now, that may sound kind of peculiar, but what Aquinas will do with that is try to argue that what would a being whose essence is its very existence be like? And I submit for everyone's consideration that all of these superlative attributes of God that traditional Christian theism celebrate, omniscience, omnipotence, all-knowing, all-good, all-powerful, all of the omnis and stuff, they all cascade inexorably from this central doctrine that God is pure being itself. So I tell my students, I teach a course, in fact, teaching it this semester on contemporary atheism. Mm-hmm. We go through various kinds of atheism, including the Cambridge Companion to Atheism as one of our texts. Mm-hmm. And I think atheism is not merely false. I think it's absolutely incoherent, because in this classical model, as I sometimes, some people might refer to this Aristotelian Thomistic tradition, in that classical model, if someone said God doesn't exist, it's really tantamount to saying nothing exists, because nothing could exist unless there was something whose very essence was to exist itself, which is what he argues. So Aquinas' cosmological argument is more than just, and I like all these others, by the way, but it's more than just, hey, we've got fine-tuning in the universe that looks like an intelligent designer. I think those are great arguments, and they're easier to make than maybe the metaphysics. But when you get down to it, you finally go, wow, this argument is, if you deny the conclusion of the argument, you are in effect denying that anything exists at all, which no atheist is going to do. So there has to be something whose very essence is existence itself. And that's what Aquinas' innovation, and I would submit that's what turns, in many respects, Aristotle's pagan philosophy into the Christian philosophy that Thomism is.
Yes, you know, and also Aquinas' view of faith and reason was also significant. What was it? And it differed from the theological perspectives of his time, didn't it?
Absolutely. In many respects, yes. And I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's another one of these that we could have said earlier when I was kind of going through a list. That was one that's important, and I shouldn't have left it out. And that is the relationship of faith and reason. It's even more telling today as a debate. And in my philosophy courses that I teach, we explore about a handful, 5 different views on the relationship of faith and reason. Of course, the atheists are just going to have this caricature that faith is just believing something you know isn't true, kind of nonsense. We're like, well, there may be people that are that, but that's really not the Christian view.
Yes.
But then you have others where faith is like a pragmatism, what works in your life, you know, what works for you. But in Aquinas, and not just Aquinas, faith and reason boil down to this, that reason is believing something on the basis of demonstration, whatever that means, right? So if someone makes a claim, then if you believe that claim because you saw it demonstrated to be true. Let's take, for example, my favorite example to give is Fermat's last theorem, the mathematician, the 17th century mathematician, mm-hmm. Pierre de Fermat. And Fermat, he proposed all these mathematical theorems over his lifetime, and every one of them has been proven to be either true or false, every one of them except one. And it became known as Fermat's last theorem because no mathematician has been able to prove whether he's right or wrong or not. And it was for a long time the longest enduring math enigma. It finally got proven in the late 90s, in 1998, to be true by Andrew Wiles at Princeton University. Now, the proof is like 111 pages in the annals of mathematics, okay? So if somebody came along and said, you know, it's Fermat's last theorem is true, and you say, Andrew Wiles says, yes, well, why does he believe it's true? He believes it's true because he's got the demonstration. He saw that it was true. So you could think different things can be demonstrated. If somebody said, well, Abraham Lincoln didn't have a beard, well, what kind of question is that? Well, that's historical. That's not mathematical. Or if someone said, well, you know, he was wrong in suspending habeas corpus during the war between the states in the 19th century. Well, that's more of a political slash moral question. Different kinds of claims have different protocols and methods and procedures to demonstrate it to be true or false, right? Mm-hmm. But, and so that, if you believe it on the basis of the demonstration, then that said you hold something by reason. In contrast, faith is believing something on the basis of authority. Now, there's a couple of things to not miss about this. If somebody asked me, well, Richard, do you believe that Fermat's last theorem is true? I'd say, yes. Well, have you seen the demonstration? Well, not really. I've seen that there is a demonstration, but I can't get past the first line of the demonstration before I'm lost, right? Well, how do you know it's true? Well, I trust Andrew Wiles. Well, here's the thing that people miss about faith and its relationship to reason. I would have to know enough about Andrew Wiles by reason to know that he's worth trusting in those areas that I can't assess the demonstration on my own. In other words, I just didn't believe any Yahoo that came along and told me anything about Fermat's last theorem. Reason was able to judge, well, no, Andrew Wiles is a bona fide mathematician. His demonstration was vetted by peer review mathematicians around the world. And so I would be a fool not to believe that it's true, but it's not because I believe it by reason. Namely, I didn't see the demonstration. I believe it on the authority of legitimate authorities. So reason judges when authorities are legit and when you don't have access to it. So let's map that then on top of the question that really matters to us. And that is, we generally don't use the word faith. If somebody said, well, I believe Andrew Wiles because he's a mathematician, I probably wouldn't say, well, I have faith in Andrew Wiles. I probably wouldn't use that term in English, but that's kind of what I'm meaning. I'm trusting him when he tells me, right? But what about things that are of eternal import? Here's something I would love to ask an atheist sometime if I get a chance. If there really was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Father of the Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, if that really was true, I know you don't believe it, Mr. Atheist, but let's say that it was true. And then second, let's suppose he did give us his book that is inerrant and infallible. I know you don't believe that, but let's just say for the sake of argument that he did. Then am I a fool for believing what a book tells me when I believe that that book was given to me by an all-loving, omniscient, omnipotent God? And I would like to think the atheist would go, well, no, I mean, in that situation, you'd be a fool not to believe it. Okay. Now, it still tells me things I can't verify by any kind of demonstration. I can't prove I'm going to rise from the dead. But Jesus says in John 5, he's going to raise everyone from the dead. and those who have done good unto the resurrection of life, and those who have done evil unto the resurrection of condemnation. And I know some hearers may go, well, wait a minute, I thought we weren't saved by doing good. In the very next chapter, John, when his detractors perhaps were asking him, what must we do to do the works of God? He said, this is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent, which he's talking about himself. So we trust God when he tells us that he pays for our sins through his son on the cross, raised him from the dead to vindicate that, and then he'll give us the gift of eternal life if we trust him for it. So I've got to decide whether I'm going to take him at his word. So what gets missed, I think, in a lot of contemporary debates about faith and reason, particularly among skeptics like the atheists, is probably not entirely their fault in that they might actually meet Christians that are this way in the marketplace. Right. But they should do the due diligence, say, what are the best that Christians have thought? Faith isn't just believing something when common sense tells you not to, or just a leap into the dark. It's trusting an authority, but that authority is demonstrated to be authority that you can know by reason, or at least can. You know, you might still not, but at least you can. And that's the distinction that's very explicit in Aquinas when he makes that. So we believe things that are assented to by someone else that we couldn't basically have access to on our own. And that's what we mean when we say we have faith and trust what God tells us in his word about our eternal destiny, for example.
Yeah. And I think Aquinas also had some classic arguments for the existence of God that we still use to this day.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Tell us about
it. Yeah. So it's interesting because pretty much any kind of introductory text to philosophy, in at least in most American universities that I'm familiar with. Now, it may be different in other places in the world, but at least here in the U.S., and probably in Anglo-American philosophy departments, they all have their obligatory, you know, mention of Aquinas. Just like most of the luminaries from philosophical history, they get a little space, you know, as you go through the history of ideas and stuff. So Aquinas always has his. Well, in virtually every instance that I've ever encountered, both as a student and a professor in philosophy, the one thing that gets mentioned in Aquinas is his arguments for God's existence. If nothing else is said, at least those get in. And there's probably a lot of reasons for that, not the least of which is that's probably the most important question, whether people will admit it or not, is does God exist? But it's also convenient to list them because the ones that he give, there are five just laconic, pithy little arguments that you could write out on a single page. So it's like, well, if we're going to mention anything, first of all, that's probably one of the most interesting things. And second, it's one of the easiest because I can just give it in a couple of column inches in my book and move on and stuff. So that became known as his five ways. There were five arguments for the existence of God. Patrick, when I did my dissertation at the University of Arkansas, I did my dissertation on the second of those five ways, what is called efficient causality, which people would probably more commonly refer to it as a cosmological argument. One of the things I discovered in my doctoral research was how seldom commentators on the five ways didn't consider the philosophical context in which he gave those five ways, whatever that philosophical context is. And so I found about maybe a half or more of the resources that I was, when I was looking for this, just totally misunderstood his arguments because they didn't consider what those arguments meant in the context of his broader philosophical view, which he obviously, I started to say, obviously, maybe it's not obvious unless someone's actually seen it. These five ways are given right at the beginning of his big multi-volume magnum opus called the Summa Theologia. They're right at the very beginning. So obviously he hasn't spent any time on background assumptions and terminological definitions. And he didn't because he just, it's like the second thing he brings up, he starts talking about God's existence and then he's off to the races. So it's understandable, I suppose, for some people when they read it so early on in this magnum that they figure they can just take arguments at face value. And I would submit to your viewers and hearers that that can be a fatal mistake. That is fatal in the sense you're going to drastically misunderstand the argument if you don't already know what he obviously assumed his readers already knew in the 13th century. That is, everybody knew Aristotle. Everybody knew Aristotle's four causes, so that when he talks about efficient cause, he doesn't have to define that. And so what I argued, among other things in my dissertation, was, okay, so undoubtedly, he's assuming everybody knows what efficient causality means, though he doesn't define it. He just figures, well, nobody doesn't know Aristotle, do they? I thought, if that's true, then might it be the case that there are other assumptions that he's playing off of and really serve as the context that he doesn't define that might make a difference in how things are understood? And that's what one of the things I argue. And one of those assumptions is his concept of existence. And unless somebody understood what he already thought about what it meant to exist, then to argue for God's existence ultimately won't really have a lot of content. It just kind of seemingly doesn't get you many places. But here's the thing to notice. I'll end with this part. Where that comes in his five pithy little arguments that he gives is at the front end, what happens as soon as he gives those arguments is then an inexorable cascade of all of these classical attributes of God. Starts with simplicity and then goodness, you know, omnipotence, omniscience. They're just downstream from that. And they all stem from that basic starting point on his metaphysics, that the God that he's proving exists is not just like Thor or Zeus or Hermes or any number of gods that people might run into in the Greek pantheon. It's not just some thing out there that we could argue does or does it not exist, like we might argue about UFOs as we're arguing today, or does Santa Claus exist? You could have all these arguments, and then God comes along. Well, what about God? You know, does he exist? And we kind of, some people give these arguments, go, yeah, but when we're talking about God, we're talking about something that's unique, because we're talking about an infinite being whose very essence is to exist and gives existence to all creation. That's what we mean, at least. So that's what he does. And so the first one's called the argument for motion. I lied to you. I told you I'd end with that thought, but just to kind of answer your question. His first one was the argument for motion. Unfortunate English translation. The better word would be change. So when you see a leaf go from green to brown, as Stevie Wonder would have said in his inner visions, I don't know if leaves go to green and brown in some places in the world, but they do in the Southeast U.S. That's called motion in Aristotle. Even though the leaf didn't move, it's not locomotion. It just means change. So you got the argument from motion, the argument from efficient causality, the argument from necessary being, the argument from the graduation of perfection, and the argument from teleology are his five ways in question two of his Summa Theologiae, part one, question two.
Yes, and another one pillar you mentioned was his understanding of natural law, which was a tremendous influence later on philosophical and legal traditions. So tell us about the natural law and how that really influenced culture. And you mentioned how much it influenced the writing of the Declaration
Absolutely.
And the Constitution here in the United States.
Absolutely. What a sad commentary it is on the progress or deterioration of jurisprudence in the United States when you go from the Declaration of Independence mm-hmm. to when Clarence Thomas was going through his Senate confirmation hearings. Lawrence Tribe, who was professor of constitutional law at Harvard University and actually wrote and consulted for constitutions in other countries in the world as they're formulating constitutions, he wrote an op-ed piece in the New York Times. You know, people old enough, maybe my age, might remember those confirmation hearings, and they were fraught with a lot of controversy and scandal. But probably what most people think they remember were these allegations of sexual misconduct at an earlier government appointment when he was Solicitor General, and the Anita Hill and all those kind of. Lawrence Tribe, though, no fan of Clarence Thomas, in his op-ed said, no, you know what the real controversy was, what got the senators all in a tizzy, was the fact that at some point Clarence Thomas said he held the natural law.
Yeah.
And I just go, okay, so all these guys break out in a rash when a potential Supreme Court justice believes in natural law theory, when natural law was our birth.
Right.
That was our birth certificate as Americans. They go, wow, how did we get there? The key, I think, with respect to natural law and morality and human morality is the notion of teleology. So teleology is this idea that given what a thing is, its whatness would be its essence. Given what something is, then it possesses these capacities, or Aristotle's word would be potencies, but these capacities to change in a certain direction towards a certain goal. So a papaya seed is not going to become a whale, no matter how long and you let it. It's never, ever able to become anything other than a papaya tree. That's it. Now, it might fail to do that if it's, you know, burned in a fire or eaten by an animal. It might fail, but left to its own devices, it will inevitably become a full-grown, healthy papaya tree. And that's what it will do. But why? Because it has this nature, its whatness, its essence, that sets it on this trajectory. Well, in Aristotle and then Aquinas later on, any natural object, so we're not talking about artifacts like a cell phone, for example, or a laptop, but any natural object, a dog, a tree, whatever, has a teleology by virtue of its essence and nature. So what constitutes the good of that thing is when it fulfills its sort of purpose, its sort of goal, it reaches that goal that's completely filled. And by the way, just to interrupt myself, one important thing I think for people to bear in mind is when we start having these discussions here about natural law, one of the first things I do when I talk about this subject is to alert the audience. You've got to understand the difference between good and moral good. Mm-hmm. Typically, in my experience, in just conversations, when people use the categories good and evil, they almost always mean moral good. Unless it's obvious, like if they say, well, this pineapple here tastes good, we don't mean it tastes morally good. That doesn't make any sense. What we mean by this pineapple tastes good is that it ought to taste by virtue of being a pineapple. A good knife has the characteristics that it ought to have, not a moral ought, but that it ought to have by virtue of being a knife. It wouldn't make sense for somebody to go, well, that's not a very good knife you're trying to sell me. And I go, well, why do you say that? Well, the blade's all dull and pitted and stuff. And, you know, I said, well, what do you think? Well, I think the knife ought to have a sharp blade. It wouldn't make any sense for me to go, well, who are you to say that a knife ought to have a sharp blade? You're trying to impose your morality on me? So you go, no, that's just what it is to be a knife, is to have a sharp blade. It's a bad knife when it has a dull blade. It's a good knife when it has a sharp blade. So if you take that kind of talk and you talk about, well, what is a good, and then fill in the blank of anything that has, that's a natural object. What's a good horse? What's a good lion? What's a good tree? What's a good dog? In every instance, you're basically meaning it has all of its capacities that it ought to have by virtue of the kind of thing that it is. Here is where the story then gets very interesting, because not only in Aristotle, but also in Aquinas and other thinkers as well, there's something different about human beings among all animals. And that is that human beings have rationality and free will, and not free will in necessarily in the sense in which Calvinists and Arminians debate that. They're connected, but they're not exactly the same. This is more of a philosophical notion. I think there's a way to define this that's relatively indifferent to that theological debate in Romans 9 and stuff. What you mean by free will is that a human being has the capacity to deliberate among competing goods, some of which goes against what it is to be a human being. A lion will never not act like a lion unless it's sick or injured. It never won't be a lion. It doesn't identify as a cheetah, whatever, right? Mm-hmm. But a human can act in a way that detracts from what it is to be a good human being. Now, people may go, well, wait a minute, you're sneaking something in here, because who are you to say what a good human being is? And my first reaction to that is, well, first of all, this isn't the first time we've had this conversation as human beings. We've been talking about what is it to be a human being for thousands and thousands of years. Yeah. And people would be startled to see a fairly unified picture of what a good human is. It's a person who's kind. It's a person who's faithful, keeps his promises, doesn't hurt other people. You just go down this list. Everybody recognizes that as a good human. So what makes it moral when we do it is precisely because we have the capacity to not do it or work against that. No other creature on the planet, sensible creatures like a lion or whatever, they don't have that capacity to do anything but what their instinct makes them.
Wow.
Once again, we've run out of time. Thank you for joining us here on Evidence and Answers. Our goal is to bring you the love of Christ and to equip you in your faith to always be ready to give a response. If you would like to hold an apologetics conference or series of teachings at your facility, contact Pat by calling him in Hawaii. That number is 483-0586, or you may email him through the Evidence and Answers website. That's evidenceandanswers.org. Be sure to browse through our listing of topics on our site. We have everything from atheism to Zen Buddhism. You will also find articles and additional audio for you to listen to or download. An additional location to find Pat's messages is on YouTube. Look up Evidence and Answers and hit the subscribe button. To keep quality broadcasts like Pat's on the air, we rely on generous financial support from you, our listeners. Donating is simple. Just log on at evidenceandanswers.org. Evidence and Answers is grateful for one of our sponsors, the Honolulu Christian Church. If you don't have a home church and are looking for a place to grow in your faith, check out the Honolulu Christian Church. For service times, log in at honoluluchristian.org. Join us again next time on the air or online as we provide compelling reasons for faith in Christ. That's Evidence and Answers with Pat Zukeran.